There are good ways and bad ways to resolve conflict. Here's Skip Heitzig with an example of a bad way.
Some people resolve conflict by not resolving conflict. They never deal with it. Don't want to talk about it. And they give the cold shoulder to the mate. Honey, what's wrong? Nothing. It seems like, oh no, nothing wrong. Why do you ask? Oh, but honey, no. And it's awfully hard to snuggle a bobcat. But that's how many will try to resolve it, just by not resolving it. Don't deal with it. Don't talk about it.
Make the connection. Study the word of God and find the way into His love. And take the time to read, for Jesus took the time to bleed for our sins. Whoa.
Dictionary.com describes someone who is cunning as one who is artfully shrewd or subtle, sly and crafty. If there ever was anyone in the Bible who fit that description, it was Jacob. His life was marked by cunning deceptions and shrewd plots to further his gain. However, that deceit didn't always come without a price. And more importantly, however, we'll see that despite the fact that Jacob was a very shrewd planner, even his cunning couldn't thwart the purposes of God. We'll explore that some more today here in The Connection with Skip Heitzig. But before we begin, this is the last day you can get the free teaching, God is Not a Swear Word, for being a first-time caller. Just call 1-800-922-1888. Mention it's your first time to do so, and we'll send you that free teaching. Or you can also write us at The Connection. That's P.O. Box 95707, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87199. Now, let's continue our study through the book of Genesis as we see God's plan for humanity unfold, even in the midst of a life that often relied more on its own schemes than God's.
And make the connection.
Turn once again to Genesis chapter 30, and let's join Skip Heitzig for the rest of this study.
And God listened to Leah, evidently then means she had prayed, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Now the writer, Moses of Genesis, wants you to know that it's because God did it that they had the child. God listened to the prayer and gave her another son. And Leah said, God has given me my wages, because I have given my maid to my husband. And so she called his name Issachar, which means hired or for sale. And Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I've borne him six sons. And so she called his name Zebulun, which means to dwell. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah, which means judgment. It was very difficult to be a woman in those days. Here's just a little insight. When a woman was about to give birth, they brought in the food and the singers and the wine, and they were all ready to party hardy if a boy was born. If a girl came out, well, congratulations, but pack up the wine and the party attire and we'll see you next time. She's competing with her sister. She now has 6-0. That's the score, 6-0. And she has a daughter. The daughter is mentioned, but her name is Judgment. Verse 22 is a highlight. Then God remembered Rachel. God listened to her and opened her womb. So, after the mandrake madness was over, that didn't work, but prayer did. She's trusting in the Lord. She's leaning on Him, and the Lord opened up her womb. She conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. And so she called his name Joseph, which means to add, and said, "The Lord shall add to me another son." Now, Joseph, we'll get to later, he dominates the last 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. He is the one who was sold out of jealousy by his brothers into Egypt. He is in Potiphar's house. He will eventually become a ruler in Egypt, in fact, the prime minister, and deliver the world from a famine. But his name is interesting because it really is a prophecy. The Lord will add to me yet another son. Now, she's going to have two children. The second son will be Benjamin, but he won't come around for a while. But Joseph, her one and only up to now son, is born by natural childbirth. So far, it's a sad picture. It's a dysfunctional family. It's a family that never learned how to resolve conflict, and children were placed in the middle of adults who are at war with each other. Now, I want you just to think for a moment about how couples resolve conflict. And people do it different ways. Some people resolve conflict by not resolving conflict. They never deal with it. Don't want to talk about it. And they give the cold shoulder to the mate. "Honey, what's wrong?" "Nothing." It seems like, "Oh no, nothing wrong. Why do you ask?" "Oh, but honey, no." And it's awfully hard to snuggle a bobcat. But that's how many will try to resolve it, just by not resolving it. Don't deal with it. Don't talk about it. But it's still lying there. Other people deal with conflict by just kind of letting it simmer. They'll be very passive about it, but they just let it simmer. And then it simmers a little more. And a little more, until eventually they can't control it and they blow up like a volcano and take half the house with them. Others place their children in the middle of their conflict. If that ever happens, please don't be surprised if your children grow up to handle conflict exactly the same way it's been modeled to them. If you use your children, like these two gals, as weapons, that's a mistake, pitting one against the other. I see husbands and wives using their children as weapons, especially if there's a divorce. Other parents worship their children, alienating their spouse. It's now all about the child, all about the baby, all about that child, and the whole life. So what happens is when the empty nest comes around, they're so used to neglecting the spouse and not nurturing that relationship, and it's all about child-centered parenting. Once the child leaves the home, they look at each other and say, "Now who are you? And why should I remain with you? Give me a good reason." Best way to resolve conflict is to sit down, look each other in the eye, get a mediator if need be, a counselor, a pastor if need be, somebody skilled at biblical counseling. But put your heart on the table and deal honestly and be submissive to the Lord's will. And ask for forgiveness. And then move on. Jacob did none of that in his family, and neither did these two gals. And you'll see their children as they grow. Enough said. The second part of this chapter, and we want to go quickly, is the workplace. He works for Uncle Laban. Now watch what happens. It came to pass when Rachel had born Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and my own country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go. For you know my service and what I have done for you." You betcha, 14 years of that service. And Laban said to him, "Please stay. If I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake." Then he said, "Name your wages, and I will give it." See the word experience? Some of the modern translations rightfully translate it divination. "For I have learned by divination that the reason I'm so blessed is because you're here." That is more accurate. Laban was also superstitious. The idea that omens and signs would predict the future, because the pagan belief is that evil forces control the world, not a sovereign God. Now, he uses God's name because he's clever. The Lord has blessed me. Yahweh is the word. Has blessed me because of you. But don't be fooled by this cat. He's not interested at all in Jacob's God, only the blessings that will come from Jacob's God. Stay. Dude, I feel so much better when you're around. Because he was blessed because of his sake. That's a beautiful principle. And it's a promise. God had promised Abraham that the descendants of Abraham would be the source of blessing to the world. Through you and your offspring, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And it's wonderful when God blesses other people because of you. It's a wonderful thought, is it not, that you could be the reason that other people get blessed? Well, it happened with Isaac. Isaac went down to Gerar, and King Abimelech of Gerar realized that God blessed him, the king of Gerar, because of Isaac. Later on, chapter 40, 41, Joseph will be down in Potiphar's house in Egypt, and Potiphar will be blessed for Joseph's sake. Laban realizes that's happened to him. Jacob said to him, verse 29, "You know how I've served you, and your livestock has been with me. For what you had before I came was little, and it has increased to a great amount. The Lord has blessed you since my coming. And now, when shall I also provide for my own house?" And he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. Let me pass through all of your flock today, removing from there all the speckled and spotted sheep, all the brown ones among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats, and these shall be my wages. So my righteousness will answer for me in time to come. When the subject of my wages comes before you, everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats and brown among the lambs will be considered stolen, if it is with me." And Laban said, "Oh, that it were according to your word." Now that means, I don't know if I can trust you or not. You have one con artist facing another con artist, and they don't trust each other. Now what's the deal here? Here's the deal. Jacob is basically saying, "Laban, all of the purebred blue ribbon stock, the best, they're yours. Your flocks have increased because of me, but the best should be yours. I'll take the leftovers. All I want is the opportunity to build my own flock." So, verse 35, he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, everyone that had some white in it, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and gave them into the hand of his sons. Now, Laban takes the lambs Jacob said he wanted. He takes them, gives them to his sons. And he puts 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flock. So here's what's happening. Laban doesn't trust Jacob. Takes the ones he said he wanted, puts them in a flock by himself, and separates them so that at any time Laban could go check on that flock to make sure that Jacob hadn't stolen any others to add to it. He doesn't trust him. He's keeping a close eye on him. Now Jacob took for himself... Verse 37, here's, if you thought it was weird up till now, it gets even weirder. Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar and of almonds and chestnut trees, peeled white strips in them, and exposed the white which was in the rods. And the rods which he had peeled, he set before the flocks in the gutters, that is the feeding troughs or the drinking troughs, in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they come to drink. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. Now you're thinking by now, what on earth is going on? And I have to say, I'm not quite sure. Some, and there's different explanations for this, think it's a selective breeding process whereby he's keeping tallies with him with these different rods that have markings on them. So selectively he could breed them. But most people think that just like the mandrakes were superstitious for Rachel, these rods are superstitious for Jacob. They did nothing at all. But it was based upon the superstition that the embryo within a female would be affected by whatever the female sees at the time of and after, in the initial stages after conception. That was their belief. If they saw something weird, it's going to affect the outcome. It had nothing at all to do with the outcome. God was in control, just like he was in control of human gestation. He's in control of blessing the flock. But here's the result. Jacob separated the lambs, made the flocks face toward the streaked and the brown flock of Laban, brown in the flock of Laban, but he put his own flocks by themselves and did not put them with Laban's flock. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger livestock conceived, that Jacob placed the rods before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in, so the feebler were Laban's and the stronger were Jacob's. Thus, the man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. There's something you should know, and I think this is one of the reasons it's here. There's a play on words in the original Hebrew, I'm told by the commentators. Do you remember back when we talked about Esau and the alternate name he was given, the name of Edom, which means red? And there was a play on words that with red stew, old man Red had his blessing taken from him. It's a play on words. The word Laban means white. So there's a play on words with the white that's on the shafts or the rods of these pieces of wood and Laban himself. As if to say, old Whitey got outsmarted and God added to his flocks and strengthened the flock of Jacob. And it was God doing it regardless of what Jacob did or didn't do. God added to the flock. How do I know that? Because in chapter 28, the Lord appears to Jacob when he's on the way to Uncle Laban's. And he said, I want you to know something, Jacob. I am the God who's going to bless you. I'm going to be with you wherever you go, and I'm going to bless you, and you're going to be a blessing to others. So God is simply doing what God promised before he got there that he would do. He's blessing him. Blessed him with many children, and now he is increasing and strengthening his flock. Let's bring it to a close and see how this fits into communion. This guy's home life was an utter mess. His work situation, an utter mess. But in the midst of that mess, God superimposed his will and brought a great blessing. Out of what you might call the worst family came the best blessing. And what was the best blessing? The Jewish nation that brought forth the Messiah to fulfill the promise, in you all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Why would God ever bless these folk? These are weirdos eating mandrakes and pulling stuff off of sticks and all of this trickery and conniving. Well, what a horrible family. Yet God blesses the most unlikely and will take the very worst and often make the very best out of it. And again, the prime example is the cross. The worst event in human history, from a human perspective, would be killing God. From any perspective, killing God, doing away with God, that's a tragedy, that's horrible. Yes, it was a travesty of justice. It was a breach of justice. But God was behind the scenes working it all out because of the death of his son. He could save human beings who believe in him. There's a philosopher from Boston College named Peter Kreeft who puts it this way. Suppose you're the devil. Now, I know that's going to be hard for some of you to imagine that. For some others, maybe not so hard. But suppose you're the devil. You're the enemy of God, and you want to kill him, but you can't. However, he has this ridiculous weakness of creating and loving human beings whom you can get at. Aha! Now you've got hostages. So you simply come down into the world, corrupt humankind, and drag some of them to hell. When God sends prophets to enlighten them, you kill the prophets. Then God does the most foolish thing of all. He sends his own son, and he plays by the rules of the world. You say to yourself, I can't believe he's that stupid. Love must have addled his brains. All I have to do is inspire some of my agents, like Herod, Pontius Pilate, Caiaphas, and the Roman soldiers, and get him crucified. And that's what you do. And so there he hangs on the cross, forsaken by man and seemingly forsaken by God, bleeding to death and crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? What do you feel now as the devil? You feel triumph. You feel vindication. But of course, you couldn't be more wrong. This is his supreme triumph and your supreme defeat. He has struck his heel into your mouth, you bit it, and that blood has destroyed you. The very worst thing in history became the very best thing in history. Now, if that is true with the cross, couldn't that be true with lesser tragedies? I want you to think tonight about your own life. You might have a very difficult home life. You may have a very difficult work environment. And maybe you're tempted, like Rachel and like Jacob, to sort of descend to the lower level and get legitimate needs met at an illegitimate source. That's idolatry, by the way. It's the meaning of idolatry. Getting your needs met at an unauthorized, illegitimate source. Instead of saying, in the midst of this mess, oh Lord, redeem it and make it something wonderful. Shape my life, my children's life, for your glory. He did it at the cross, and he can do it in your life and mine.
Well, there isn't anything in our lives that God can't ultimately use for his glory. With our limited perspective, sometimes it's hard to see that. However, God's perspective is infinite, and because of that, all he sees in our life is possibilities, even in the most difficult circumstances. Well, it's on that hopeful note that we'll end our time for today. But you know, one thing that we ultimately need to trust God for is faith. So here's something to help you better understand what faith is.
Pinning down a firm concept for the definition of faith is about as easy as holding a cloud or preventing a wave from returning to the sea. Faith oftentimes seems like a nebulous, ambiguous concept without any real substance, and yet we're told it's one of the key foundations of our Christian walk. How do we build something solid upon something so seemingly insubstantial? If you've ever struggled with these kinds of questions, Chuck Smith's book, simply entitled Faith, will provide you with the comfort of definitive answers. Discover what faith is, how it works in our lives, and what it will produce as part of the daily Christian life. Order the book Faith for just $15 when you call 1-800-922-1888. Faith in the Christian life doesn't have to feel like a fog over San Francisco Bay. It can be firm, solid, and something we can grasp. Find out how in Chuck Smith's book Faith. Get your copy for just $15 when you call 1-800-922-1888 or visit connectionradio.org.
And of course, if you'd like a copy of today's teaching, we'd be more than happy to send you one. Each copy is just $6, so perhaps you could get a couple of copies and share them with someone you know who might need a little hope and encouragement in their lives. Just call 1-800-922-1888 or visit connectionradio.org. Or if you prefer, you can also write us, and perhaps your letter will be one we select to share here on the program. Our mailing address, P.O. Box 95707, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87199. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you as well for your continued support of The Connection.
And make the connection.
Jacob's life just gets more and more complicated, and we'll see how as we continue with our study of Genesis next time here in The Connection, a presentation of Connection Communications, connecting you to God's never-changing truth in ever-changing times.